He is the new voice of talk radio, Alexander Danilov.
Oh, hey, oh, I guess my line was on mute. I apologize. Welcome to Solutionsology Radio. The topic of tonight and the hierarching conversation that we're going to have is about risk. And joining me to speak about risk and how it affects us, is it good? Is it bad? Should we be more mindful? How do we become more mindful and aware? How do we assess risk, whether it's good or bad, all that kind of stuff? The author of The Art of Risk, Kate Sukel. The New Science of Courage, Caution, and Chance. Kate, thank you so much for coming on tonight, and congratulations on this book. Kate? Okay, so let's see what's going on here. Kate, can you hear me?
I can hear you. It says I'm muted, though. Can you hear me now?
We should be good now. Sorry about that. Some tech issues, but did you hear what I was saying beforehand?
Yeah, no, thanks for having me on the show. I'm excited to talk.
So, again, I apologize for the tech issues. I might have to edit that out. I typically don't do that because everything goes smoothly. But, you know, on occasion, tech happens. That's a risk we take when we do live shows. But let's talk about this book. This is your third book. Your other books we'll talk about a little later on. I want to just spotlight them as well. But this is something that, look, a lot of books have been written about this, but this is a little bit different. You're trying to create a different vision and a different idea of what risk is, what it is, what's impacting it. Is it good or is it bad? And I think that's very special because we always associate risk with negative and being averse to it, except for those maybe 5 to 10% of people who, you know, just take risk and they base jump, as you mentioned in the book, they trade or whatever it might be. But that's not really what risk is all about. So I'd like for you to introduce that and obviously how this book came about.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, risk is sort of a hard concept for a lot of people to get a handle on. And I think if you plucked 10 experts from the business world, epidemiological world, and from the science world, they'd give you different answers of what risk is. In fact, I think if you plucked 10 people just at random off the street, they'd give you a different answer. And that's because we really do talk about it in extremes. It's the stuff that is, you know, going to kill us. It's going to injury, death, bankruptcy, all the worst things in life, incarceration, drug addiction. But then on the other hand, we talk about it as if it's the greatest thing ever. It is the path to all our dreams. You know, he who dares wins. You gotta risk big to win big. So it's no wonder that we are sort of stymied by risk because we can't really get a good grasp of what it is. But it was interesting when we distill it down, it's a really simple thing. It's just any decision or behavior that may have an outcome, an uncertain outcome, and that uncertain outcome may be negative. So instead of it being a personality trait, and I think a lot of times we talk about people as if they're risk takers, you know, he's a risk taker, she's a risk taker, they're so different than me. What it really boils down to is a decision-making process, one in which we don't really know what the outcome of our choice is going to be. And when you think about it, that means it's applicable to every decision we make every single day. And that's whether we're, you know, base jumping, whether we're playing that final table, you know, at a poker tournament, or whether we're just deciding to have that third cup of coffee in the morning.
So with that, Kate, is you said it right, and we don't know what it's going to be. We don't know what it's going to lead to. We look at everything in hindsight, and in hindsight, we're all geniuses. We're all Captain Hindsights, and it's so easy to make decisions after the fact. But when you're doing something that's perceived as risky, or actually is risky by the textbook definition, how you're outlining it throughout the book, and now, so we don't know. And you, it's talked about a lot towards the end of the book, is that hindsight makes us feel good about it after the fact if it worked out, and might make us a little more daring, might make us do different things that may be out of our nature as well, but it is out of hindsight. Let's talk about that a little bit, because we look at hindsight as something that's welcome, but we can't live life through that because it already happened. Yes, you can learn from it,
right?
And that's the whole thing with failure. Steph Davis, you mentioned that, how they look at failure. It's not just failure to them. In hindsight, it's a learning experience as well.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I think what's really sort of interesting, once you start thinking about it in terms of a process, then you need to get into, like, how the brain processes decisions. And certainly, you know, Daniel Kahneman wrote this great book, Thinking Fast and Slow. He talked about sort of our fast-thinking systems, the emotional systems that make us want to leap ahead, and then our frontal lobes or our slower-thinking systems that make us hold back. But the thing is the brain, if we were to try to make what the brain's job is as simple as possible, it's in the prediction business. It's trying to figure out what is coming at us in the world next, so that we can, you know, survive and hopefully thrive. And because at any given second of the day, the world is bombarding you with all kinds of sensory information. Some of it you're aware of, some of it you're not. And your brain's trying to decide what you actually have to pay attention to. And so when you have this uncertainty, you know, the brain wants to fill in the blanks. It wants to take a lot of shortcuts. And the thing is that if you're well-versed in the subject, if you kind of know what's going on, the brain's going to do a good job of doing that. If you're overly emotional, or if you're stressed out, or if it's something totally new, your brain might not be so good at it, and that can lead you astray. And that's where it really gets important. If it's a simple process, then it's something that actually each and every one of us can harness and use, you know, to our benefit instead of to our detriment.
Once again, I'm speaking with Kate Sukel. She's the author of The Art of Risk, great new book, just came out early March. Was able to get a copy of it, and I loved it. As I was telling you before we went on, Kate, I actually had to fight my wife for it. All I wanted her to do is read a couple paragraphs, and this is towards the end of the book. Just wanted to read a couple paragraphs and how detailed you went into the open brain surgery that you were seeing, and I cringe, and I get, you know, a little squeamish even reading that kind of stuff because you paint so visual of it. But she looked and she didn't kind of thing, and what does she do? She doesn't give it back to me for a while, so I had to fight back to get it, to be able to finish.
I like your
book.
Wife.
she's feisty, especially when it's something like this. But I want to get technical on this, right? So we have the brain. It's the best computer ever created. We don't know what the heck it is to a large degree, because as much as we do know, there's a lot we do not know. But we do know for the most part, what's controlling what as it's happening, and machinations like that within our brain. So we know that when our fist starts to clench and we get that amygdala hijacked, that we're not being ourselves at that point. We're reacting purely off our basic, most primal instincts, and we're getting ready to that fight or flight. We have the reptilian brain. We have the rational part of our brains. We have all these different areas of our brain that control different parts of us. And there's some people that lack in certain parts like that. So let's get technical about it. Let's talk about what controls risk. And I want to get a little deeper after that and talk about more of the psychological level with certain people who are almost mute to certain things like that.
Well, so, you know, there's a really sophisticated circuit in the brain. And it's called the mesocortical limbic circuit. And it's really sort of in charge of decision making. And what you have are sort of these deep reptilian parts of the brain, as you referred to them, an area called the basal ganglia. And some people call this the brain's reward center, and it certainly does process rewards. But more recent research really sort of characterizes it as the brain's motivation center. This is the thing that gets us up and gets us going. It has us going after food, sex, love, prestige, money, the girl, all the best things in life. But, of course, if we were to go after all the things that we wanted the very moment that we wanted them, the world would be a very hospitable place. Any parents out there that go to, like, a two-year-old's birthday party knows exactly what I'm talking about with this. It's all about rewards, not about, you know, self-control. So we also have an area of the brain, our frontal lobes, that acts as an executive control center. And it's there, if not to say no, at least not now. Hey, sex is great, but maybe not with your boss's wife. And, chocolate cake is awesome, so good, but you just ate an entire box of donuts 2 hours ago. This is a bad idea. And really, any risky decision is going to be sort of a balancing act, a little bit of a minuet between, the basal ganglia, which some scientists call the gas, the thing that is pushing you forward to take that risk, and then the frontal cortex, which scientists then call the brakes, the things that they're going to tell you, wait, hold up, let's not do this right now, the cost may be too great to bear. There are also, of course, other brain areas that are feeding into this circuit. You mentioned the amygdala, so certain things that threaten survival that deal with, what some scientists call the four Fs, fight and flight, we know. Of course, there's also feeding, and then the last F stands for reproduction. And then we have areas like the insula and then the limbic system, the brain's emotional system, and then the hippocampus, the memory. And they all sort of feed into this circuit and let us know what should we be paying attention to, what not, what could the outcome be if we move forward, what is the outcome if we stay back, and helps you come calculate out basically a decision when uncertainty is involved. They're all trying to sort of fill in as many blanks as possible.
Yep, and Kate, so some of the things that you went through, a lot of the tests, not examination, so to speak, but different tests, different strategies that professors, neurologists, all that have used to try to figure out why certain brains and why certain people do certain things, what they respond to, that reward incentive-based system that we that's so popular here in America, but maybe not so much in other parts of the world,
right.
Just because either they don't believe in it or they try to control that. They don't want people thinking that, oh, I have to get something for doing something. But we believe in a different system here. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about some of the tests that you had mentioned and, you know, what you saw, what you experienced, because one of the things that's really cool about this book is that it feels like you're holding our hand through the process and we're walking together and we're learning this, all of this together. And you knew a lot of this already, but you're learning it also as you're being inspired to eventually write this book, which is really cool.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are a lot of tests that people use to look at risk-taking. Certainly if we go back into the psychological and then the epidemiology research, you know, people are trying to figure out why people take risks. Why do they have unprotected sex and thus spread diseases, you know, like hepatitis C and HIV? Why do people, you know, continue not to wash their hands and stuff like that?
That's one of the things that skews me out the worst.
And then, you know, in the laboratory, people will use lotteries where they vary the probability that you're going to hit big on a particular lottery. They do things in terms of asking how you would respond to certain situations and different questionnaires. There's something called the sensation-seeking scale, which asks questions about how much, you know, sort of stimulation and stress you can handle in your life. And then actually what I thought was the most interesting test was something called the balloon analog risk task. And this thing sounds so silly when you try to describe it to somebody else. You're sitting in front of a keyboard, and what you're doing is you're hitting a space bar, and you're trying to blow up a balloon as big as you can before it pops. Mm-hmm. But, of course, you don't know when it's going to pop. It might be on the first space bar press. It might be on the eighth. But the more you press that bar, the more points you get, which then translate to more money later. But like I said, you don't know when it's going to pop. And at first I thought this task was so silly, and then I sat down and I started playing it, and I was like a little junkie sitting on the end of the seat, like, come on, go up here, let me get more points. Because if it pops before you sort of get out of the balloon, you lose all your points. You can lose everything. So it really does work you up. It really gets you excited. It feels a lot like, you know, speeding on a deserted country road at night, or, you know, doing something you know you're not supposed to be doing. And it is something that highly correlates with risk-taking that's seen in the real world, in the wild. So there are a variety of different ways that scientists are trying to look at risky behaviors. And what they're learning is that, you know, risk-taking, historically, we sort of used that term synonymously with impulsive behavior. We've also used it with sensation seeking. And what we're finding is there are some differences. And this is one of the great things that neuroscience is offering, as we're looking at different brain scans, as we're looking at different areas as the brain of how they work together. We're finding that impulsive behavior, which, you know, we tend to think of as that negative risk-taking, right? Having that sex without the condom, driving too fast late at night, drunk driving, doing things that will end you, you know, get you in jail or what have you. These seems to be problems with the brain's brake system, that frontal lobe. Sensation seeking, some people are just wired for stimulation. They like stress. They like to be out there. They go for different hobbies and jobs that mean that they're, you know, constantly being stimulated and bombarded. And if they can't get it at work, they're going to come home and, like, pick a fight with their spouse at the end of the night just to have that kind of level of intensity in their lives. And so these people tend to, you know, have hobbies like drag racing or extreme sports. But they're not impulsive. They just tend to like that stimulation. And so risk-taking, again, it comes down to that little simple decision-making process that's part of every decision. And so certainly people who are, you know, impulsive, they don't think things all the way through, end up making decisions that have a lot of uncertainty involved that can get them into trouble. people who are in sensation seeking may seek out hobbies or other more exciting jobs or activities to kind of raise their heart rate and their stress rate. But those three overlap. They're not exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, okay, one of the other things you wrote about extensively in the book is the term effect rich with an A. So basically that's mm-hmm. speaking to the experiences, you mentioned sensations and things like that, to see the end result or a part of the end result, maybe something that's on the way to getting what we're looking for. So mm-hmm. that also becomes almost like a drug, an addiction to get that. So I think one of the examples you used in the book is with mice and they have a shot. They're not going to do that anymore. They might stop doing that after a couple shots. But if you give them something like sugar water or something to that effect, they're going to obviously continue to press it. And it's that effect that we get, that positive feeling that you get when you press that button, that balloon doesn't pop. You want to press it again. You want to go one more time, just yep. one more. Don't pop. You know, one of those types of scenarios. So let's talk about that, obviously, as well. And why we're so addicted to the pleasures of it, whether it's shopping, something like that. A lot of times shopping mm-hmm. is not about something that you need. It's about the fact that you love walking out of the store with bags. You love people looking at you with you holding bags, especially yeah. if it's from a big brand store or an expensive store. And it's just that sensory, that experience, mm-hmm. and that's why we become impulsive in those scenarios as well.
So when we say affect rich, affect with an A, what we're talking about is emotion. But, you know, mm-hmm. basically, if you think about having emotions, they take a lot out of you physiologically. You know, you get really mad, you're going to start to sweat, you turn red, your heart rate goes up, you know, you start to clench your fists. It takes a lot out of you. So what your brain tries to do is remember the gist, those faint whispers of feeling. So, you know, that last time you got really mad at your boss or a friend or what have you, you're not going to have to drum up all of those expensive physiological, you know, output. You just have that faint whisper of emotion, that affect left over. So what that means is that our memories and our emotions can cloud decision-making, because we do have those faint whispers of emotion that are trying to, like, push us in one direction or the other. And you're right, some of it is about, you know, feeling good. Some of it's about looking good or having people see you or status or what have you. They come from all different kinds of places. But I think, you know, one of my favorite examples of this is the lottery. Anybody who's ever gone on the Powerball site knows that they're not going to win. They see the odds. One in, it's something ridiculous, like 175 million. You know, you start to think about the math, and for your ticket to be chosen, I mean, the probability is so, so slim. But then you start to think about what you would do if you got that money. And mm-hmm. you start to think about, you know, oh, I'm going to go into work tomorrow and tell my boss where he can shove it. Oh, and I'm going to help my mom who's having trouble with her mortgage. I'm just going to buy her a whole new house. And this is going to solve all my problems with sending my kids to college and this and that. And all of a sudden you start to feel really good about it, because this money, this is going to be awesome. This is going to change your life. This is going to make you so happy. Never mind that most of the time people who win money in the lottery aren't that happy. But, you know, you dredge up all these very good feelings. And all of a sudden, what that does is it changes the way that your brain fills in the blanks with this risk calculation. So instead of 1 in 175, you know, million, you know, one in that chance, that probability, all of a sudden that turns into some chance of winning. And you understand better why people who know better go in and end up buying, like, $25, sometimes $100 worth of tickets whenever the Powerball goes over, you know, 400 million or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Those good
yep.
feelings are just pushing them. Yeah. And then the same thing you can see happens with bad feelings, that negative affect. And I think that's actually a huge contributor to what's happening in the election right now, or the leading up to the election. These mm-hmm. campaigns, they've really sort of hooked into these negative feelings we have about
yep.
the economy, about where the American family is going. And so they're mm-hmm. really sort of filling in blanks in such a way that we're not looking at, okay, wait a minute, so how is he actually going to pay for this, or what is his stance on this, or what is the policy? All we sort of see are the variables that these candidates are pushing up for us to see. And mm-hmm. it can be dangerous when you're overly emotional, when affect kind of directs you in this way, because you aren't mm-hmm. looking at the whole picture. You're not detached enough to make a good rational decision. You're buoyed by these emotions, and they can often lead you astray.
And we saw that a lot, Kate, obviously with the 2008 election with Obama, and how he was able to capture not only the more racist stuff, but a lot of imagination, obviously. Whether you like him or not, whether you hate him or you love him, regardless of how your feelings about him are, as polarizing as his presidency has been, he has one of the most incredible stories there's ever been. And he's a guy who was, what, 44 when he got elected. Relative unknown, but ran what was probably the greatest, and at least in this country, the greatest election a marketing campaign in history, and tapping into different technologies and hitting people where he can hit them with different platitudes and things like that. And that was amazing. We're seeing some of that being played this time around, but obviously in a completely different light from both sides. But
in a negative fashion, I think.
Yeah, definitely more negative than 2008 was, but definitely platitudes, always trying to get people at their emotion. Usually positive campaign, unfortunately, doesn't get as many headlines. Negative does, and that's where obviously people are going with that. But that's a whole different conversation. We can talk about that for days and weeks and all the way leading up to the election. but Kate, I did want to mention the other books again. I love the new one, The Art of Risk, Your Others, which are Dirty Minds, This Is Your Brain on Sex. I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about that at least a little bit, so you can talk about this back aspect of it, because it's people feel almost like guilty or weird about having certain thoughts and things like that about that. Now, I don't want to get too personal about it, but obviously this is something that that permeates all of us. You know, this is something we're surrounded by on a daily basis. It's instinctual to think about sex. It's instinctual to think about things like that. And I'm never going to be somebody that doesn't talk about something that's important on my show, whether it makes some people feel uncomfortable. So let's make some people feel a little uncomfortable, and let's talk about this a little bit. Let's talk about this book, obviously not to get too crazy, but I did want to feature it.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, everybody knows that love can make you crazy. Of course, when we're in the throes of it, we don't think we're crazy. But, you know, when our best friend falls in love and starts, all they do is talk about their intended and they're not calling you back and they're not showing up for work and they're doing all kinds of silly things, we know they're crazy. And so I was really curious of now that we can sort of peer into the brain, and we know that the brain is the seat of all thoughts, emotion, behavior, direction. You know, what are scientists learning about why exactly, you know, love can make us so nuts? And really what's so interesting is love is kind of a form of addiction, and it's meant to be. Mother Nature definitely had something in mind when she set up the brain this way. Humans are a social species. We're meant to connect. You know, we throw around those platitudes a lot, you know, it takes a village and what have you. But, you know, in order to have successful offspring, we really need to be connected to families, to not only have those babies, but to raise them, because kids, especially human kids, are a very expensive proposition to raise. And I don't mean just money. I mean just in terms of time. You know, we carry infants for 9 months. You know, we then they're you know, toddlers are basically helpless. Actually, some kids are helpless until 18, but you know what I mean? They're basically helpless until they're a few years old. That's a huge time commitment. That's an expensive commitment. And so we need those social networks around to help us out. So it was fascinating to me to learn. And in fact, the same circuit that we were talking about with risk, the mesocortical limbic circuitry, is involved in these love and sexual behaviors. And when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense, because is there any bigger risk or reward in life than finding and then maintaining a romantic partner? There's not. So it was really fascinating to kind of look at what we're learning in the laboratories about what love is, you know, it's kind of a neurochemical mess, so to speak, and why it does have the power to affect us so.
And also, obviously, a factor in the lust aspect of it too, where we lose all control. We get that going to the beach instead and just trying to spend any time. But there's a lust aspect to it too, which is a little more ravenous and carnal. But again, that's a conversation for another day, and probably better off air. Sometimes that makes me wonder about that. But again, the book that we spoke about tonight, that we mainly spoke about, is The Art of Risk, The New Science of Courage, Caution, and Chance. That's a newer book, came out earlier this year. And the other book that we just started talking about, which I imagine made some people feel uncomfortable, which is okay, Dirty Minds, This Is Your Brain on Sex. I encourage everyone to check out these books, or at the very least, go to your site because it's free to do so. You're already paying for internet. Might as well do something a little more inspiring than just continuing to check ESPN scoreboards. And that website is katesuchel.com, and just spell it out because people always butcher my name, is KateSuchel, and that's also your Twitter handle. I encourage people to follow you there. You're also on Facebook and LinkedIn. Once again, Kate, thank you so much for going through this. This is a whole experience that you decided to share with us. I'm very grateful for it because I love about it. And prefrontal prefrontal cortex. I heard of things like that, but ventromedial prefrontal cortex. I don't know what the heck that was, but I feel a lot smarter having read it. And I know the acronym and I know what it stands for now. So next time I see it anywhere, I'll be like, oh, I know what that is. And there's a lot of other great stuff in this book that people will take from it when it comes to education and learning and having a good good leave behind, education wise. So, Kate, thanks again for coming on the show. Great conversation, and congrats on the new book.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Appreciate it. Thanks again.